Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for part two of my Texas Killing Fields episode, where today we're going to be talking about the fields from the 1980s onwards. More victims, more suspects, more theories. If you haven't watched part one from last week, then I advise you go and do that before you continue with this one, just so you actually understand what I'm talking about. In part one, I delve into where the killing fields are located, the history behind them, and the murders throughout the 1970s. And as with last week's episode, this is also going to be a fundraiser for Texas Equisearch, and very soon in this video we'll talk about the relation that nonprofit has to this case. No pressure to donate, as always, but if you can spare a few pennies, it'd be very much appreciated. And with that, let's jump straight into the episode. Heading into the 1980s, we jump to the 7th of October 1983. In a lot of sources online, you'll find the next victim called Heidi, H-E-I-D-I. But according to this book, which is my main source of the video and just an absolute bible when it comes to this case, her name was actually Heidi, H-E-I-D-E. So I'm going to refer to her as Heidi going forwards. Heidi Villareal Fye was 25 years old and had a 6-year-old daughter. She was a bartender and cocktail waitress and lived in League City, Texas. For a bit of context on the geography here, the murders in the 70s I spoke about in last video almost all happened in either Harris County or Galveston County in southeast Texas, the I-45 running through both. League City is kind of smack bang in the middle of the two. Heidi's sister said, "Heidi never met an enemy. Everyone was her friend. She was a carefree sort of girl. She loved to laugh." On the evening she disappeared, Heidi told her father, who she was living with at the time, that she was going to hitchhike into Houston to meet her boyfriend. And then she vanished. Her family quickly realised that she was gone and started searching, visiting all the places Heidi was known to frequent. They headed to a convenience store that they knew she visited often, and the clerk said that they recalled her coming in that night using a payphone to call somebody. Her body would sadly be found 6 months later on the 4th of April 1984 when a dog emerged from a wooded area off of Calder Drive, a small road off of the I-45, carrying a human skull in its mouth. Investigators soon found Heidi's body as if posed behind a tree, her clothes and a necklace found nearby in a haunting callback to the murders of the 70s. The coroner struggled to determine a cause of death for Heidi, but broken ribs suggested that she may have been beaten to death. As you might remember from part one of this video, that involved a lot of teenage girls going missing throughout the 1970s, and in each case, investigators would write them off at first as just runaways. In the case of Colette Wilson, they even told that her parents shouldn't be worried because Colette was probably just off doing drugs. Heidi's case was also not taken seriously, and she was a 25-year-old woman. One investigator said, well, what did she expect? Because she was a cocktail waitress, of course she was going to end up dead. Not long after Heidi went missing, on the 26th of October 1983, 14-year-old Sondra K. Rambo would disappear from her home in Santa Fe, Texas. Her case has baffled authorities for decades now. According to the Charlie Project, the daughter's house was found wide open and biscuits were baking in the oven. Her bag and coat were found inside, and when her family arrived home to no sign of her, they just assumed that she might have popped out to go to the shop. Only Sondra didn't arrive home. The next morning, her family reported her as missing, but once again, law enforcement thought she was a runaway. Sondra's remains have never been found, meaning that some investigators still think that she may have gone off and started a new life with a new identity, but many more make connections to the other disappearances and murders in this area, the cases we're talking about today. Sondra was just 14 years old at this time, but she would be 53 years old today. When she disappeared, she was 5'5" and 123 pounds. She was a Caucasian female with brown hair and brown eyes and a mole on her right cheek. I'll put a rendering on the screen of what she may look like today if she's still alive, but chances are she was a victim of the Texas killing fields. I mean, you don't put biscuits in the oven and then decide as they're baking that's the perfect time to run away. That just doesn't really happen. Just under a year later, 16-year-old Laura Miller disappeared from the very same convenience store that Hedy Fye was last seen at on the night she disappeared. This was on the corner of Hobbs Road and West Main Street. Just like Hedy, Laura had also been using the payphone on the 10th September 1984. The family had only just moved to their new home in League City and the home phone hadn't been connected yet. Laura wanted to call her boyfriend. Her mum Jan gave her a lift to the store that day to make the call and intended to take her home as well, but Laura wanted to spend longer on the phone and Jan had to get to work. Laura told her mum not to worry, it was only a mile home, she could walk it, it was fine. So Jan reluctantly left for work, leaving Laura at the convenience store. Her father Tim was at work as well, meaning there was nobody at home to be alerted to the fact that Laura never made it back that day. When both her parents arrived home from work that evening and Laura wasn't there, they just assumed she was out with her boyfriend. But then her boyfriend knocked on the door looking for her. As Laura had a seizure disorder, they assumed that she must have had a seizure somewhere and she must be in a lot of trouble. So they called all of the local hospitals and the police. Guess what the police said? Ran away. Laura's parents knew that that wasn't the case. Laura had her seizure medication to take and she hadn't taken it with her and she was very, very good at taking it. She wouldn't have skipped a dose. That's what enabled her to live a normal life. A couple of years passed and Laura never came home despite her parents' endless searching for her. On February 4th, 1986, the Millers read an article in the Galveston County Daily News about how just the day before, the decomposed body of an unidentified woman had been found in a Calder oil field, just 200 yards away from where Hedy had been found 2 years beforehand. And then upon a deeper search, investigators had found another body in the same area. The Millers knew there was a good chance that one of the bodies was their daughter, was Laura, and Jan rushed to the police station supplying dental records. Soon, Laura's body was identified, but her cause of death remained a mystery as she'd been out there for so long. The Millers finally had an answer as to what happened to their daughter, but as you can guess, they were furious at local law enforcement. The police had never taken them seriously and their daughter's body had been lying in a local oil field this entire time. And this is made even worse by the fact that after the discovery of Hedy, Tim had asked them to search that field properly for more bodies and investigators had declined. Tim asked them if he could search himself and they told him he couldn't, that there was a fence. And turns out there wasn't any fence. He could have gone searching for himself and he probably would have found Laura's body. Of course, this wouldn't have changed Laura's fate, but it could have provided the Millers with answers a lot sooner, and maybe they could have prevented this third yet unidentified body becoming a victim. This Jane Doe, the third body, had been murdered via a gunshot wound in her spine, and she would remain unidentified for many years, the only clue they had as to her identity being a gap between her two front teeth. Like the two other victims found in the field, she was white with shoulder-length brown hair, 5'6 to 5'8 and about 140 pounds. She was thought to be between 22 and 30 years old. Jumping forward a bit in our timeline, 7 years later in 1991, there would be another decomposed body found in the same oil field off of Calder Drive, found by horse riders. Fitting the MO of the other three women, she was white, between 24 and 34 years old, 5'3 and 130 pounds. She had long brown hair. However, unlike the other three victims found in this field, who had all been found face up, almost as if they'd been posed, this Doe, dubbed Janet Doe, was found face down. Her cause of death was ruled to be strangulation, but it was also found that she'd been beaten quite severely around the head. Both Jane Doe and Janet Doe remained unidentified until 2019, but authorities have been working on their identifications for many, many years before that. In the Mays of 2016 and 2017, there were new renderings released of the victims based on DNA phenotyping. In April 2018, detectives worked with the FBI to build their family trees. And finally, on January 29, 2019, the FBI handed over the results of their work to the League City Police Department. Their names. On Monday, the 15th of April 2019, Jane Doe was publicly identified as Audrey Lee Cook from Memphis, Tennessee, born in November 1955, making her around 30 years old at the time of her death. Audrey had moved to Houston with her girlfriend to start a new life, but she regularly stayed in contact with her loved ones back home until she eventually went quiet. Her parents got so concerned with her silence, they travelled to Houston to find her to no avail. It's thought that she could have died anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months before she was found, which is pretty broad. She might have been involved in cocaine at the time of her disappearance, both using and selling, which could be a clue as to her murderer. Janet Doe was identified as Donna Gonsulin Prudhomme, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, born in April 1957 in Port Arthur, Texas. Donna moved around a lot in the years before her death, running from an abusive relationship, but she lived in Nassau Bay, Texas in 1991. She was last seen in July 91, where she was 34 years old, for her body was found in September. Investigators believe that Donna died about 6 weeks before her death, which does work with the timeline here. She was a frequent visitor to many of the bars in the Seabrook and Nassau Bay areas, which is about 12-ish miles from where her body would later be found. She wasn't particularly close with her family, so it doesn't seem like anyone ever really noticed she was missing, assuming that she had just moved on with her life. But let's rewind back to the 1980s and to Tim Miller, who deserves a section of this video all for himself. After his daughter Laura died, Tim fell apart, as I think any parent would do. But then he set out on his mission for justice. He self-admittedly became obsessed with Laura's case and was constantly contemplating who could have been the one to kill his daughter. But one man caught Tim's eye more than anyone else, and this is where we talk about our third suspect of this series, Robert Abel. Robert Abel is undeniably a very interesting man. He had a great mind and in the 60s was one of NASA's great young engineers. He was part of the team that designed the rocket that would get the Apollo astronauts into orbit. I'm not talking your regular smart, I'm talking a smart, smart guy. But it seems that Abel struggled with personal relationships. He was married 3 times and his ex-wives would talk of his bad temper, how he would beat his horses with pipes if they misbehaved, how he would fly into rages at the smallest of things. He also happened to own and live on a ranch that was right next to the killing fields, having bought it when he moved to League City in 1983. Abel owned 1,000 acres of land on Calder Road and in 1990 bought another 11 acres right next to the oil field. There he ran a business called Stardust Trail Rides, a recreation centre where companies could hold western themed employee days and people could take photos of the children riding ponies. Abel first came to investigators' attention in 1991 after the discovery of Donna Prudhomme's body, who was known just then as Janet Doe. He seemed to be a bit too excited by the crime scene next to his house. He was overenthusiastic and showed a lot of interest. And we've seen time and time again how some criminals just can't seem to hold back their excitement over their own crimes. He asked investigators questions, he offered to help in any way he could, he loaned horses and tools for them to search the land with. He could have just been trying to be helpful, but it struck investigators as odd. They kind of had to look into this guy a bit more. And they found that he was just an odd guy in general. And then the League City PD received a phone call from Abel's ex-wife, who told them of his cruelty and anger towards both humans and horses. She told them about how when his horses died, he wouldn't bother burying them, he would leave their bodies out in the open for scavengers to eat and dispose of, which was very similar to how the 4 bodies had been found in the field. So detectives turned to the FBI for help, specifically to the Behavioural Science Unit in Quantico. They wanted help making a profile of the killer in this case, and what do you know? The profile came back fitting Abel to a T. highly intelligent, arrogant about his intelligence, and prone to outbursts of anger. He would have a history of bad relationships with women and cruelty to animals. He might live near to the crime scene and would closely follow news coverage of the killings, and if the opportunity presented itself, try and get involved with the investigation under the guise of trying to help. The coincidence was too much, and investigators used this profile to get a search warrant for Abel's property. They searched for 12 hours, they took his guns, a gold tooth, newspaper clippings he collected about the killings, his collection of amateur photography, and even took the cords from his window blinds. There was no proof at this point that any of this was connected, they just took it all to test, just in case. And testing provided no answers. The gold tooth was Abel's own, and nothing else there linked him to the murders. There wasn't much more the police could do, although he did remain their number one suspect. But Tim Miller was convinced that Abel was the one responsible for his daughter's death. Tim told J. Oliver Conroy for The Guardian, "I made Robert's life pretty miserable to say the least. I would go by his house so much it was nuts, 2-3 times a day." He said he would park his car outside Abel's house, watching him for hours on end, to the point that Abel ended up getting a restraining order. So Tim would park his car a few feet further away instead, just over the property line. I'm not condoning his behaviour, but Tim was grieving for his daughter who wanted answers. If Abel wasn't responsible for her death, then I feel sorry for him. If he was responsible, then he deserved it. One night in 1994, Tim was waiting outside Abel's house when Abel shouted at him, "All those girls were whores anyway." In a moment of blind rage, Tim gets out of his car and holds the barrel of his gun to Abel's head, demanding that he confess to being the serial killer. He managed to stop just before he pulled the trigger, realising that if Abel really was the killer here, killing him would only stop further answers being found. So Tim lowered his gun, walked back to his truck, and checked himself into a psychiatric ward that very same night, realising he had crossed a line. In 1999, Abel said to a Texas Monthly reporter that the accusations had ruined his life, saying, "My life has been destroyed, my reputation ruined, I didn't kill any of those girls, I wouldn't know how to kill." He would say that people in the street would back away from him, they'd go down different aisles at the grocery store. Everyone in League City knew what he'd been accused of, but there was never any proof. Years later, Tim Miller would approach Abel in the street, apologising for all he put him through, for getting swept away in grief and suspicion. They both cried and put the years of pain behind them. In 2005, Robert Abel would die in what the authorities would rule as an accident, when he drove his vehicle onto train tracks and waited for an oncoming train to hit him. Some think that this could have been a suicide, possibly caused by years of suspicion. Although Tim forgave and forgot, a lot of the locals didn't. Some still today think that he was a good suspect, that it could have been Robert Abel, but we don't have any more answers. After his stay in the psychiatric hospital, Tim Miller turned a corner and decided to focus his grief into something more positive, starting the Texas Equisearch Mounted Search and Recovery Team in August 2000, hence the fundraiser under this video. Texas Equisearch's purpose is to provide volunteer horse-mounted search and recovery for lost and missing persons. Tim wanted to help others who are in similar situations to him, whether their loved ones had gone missing or had been abducted or worse, like Laura. They're a non-profit organisation funded solely by donations and are currently available to conduct searches nationwide and worldwide. I've referred to Texas Equisearch so many times in videos without ever really knowing the full story behind it, so I'm so glad I know now. According to their website, Equisearch have been involved in over 1,860 searches in 42 states in the US and in Aruba, Sri Lanka, Mexico and more. They've successfully returned over 400 missing people to their families and have recovered the remains of 238 missing loved ones, many of which resulted in criminal cases and justice. Tim Miller has been a big part of many of these trials, a fundamental part in bringing justice. He's featured in news reports on talk shows local and nationwide, raising awareness of what his organisation does, and he's received multiple awards for his hard work. He's a true example of something incredible coming out of grief, helping others through his pain. I wish more than anything I could say our story ends there today, but sadly, it didn't. The disappearances continued in full force after Audrey Cook. It was the 24th of May in 1986 when 19-year-old Shelley Kathleen Sykes disappeared from Galveston. She left her job as a server at Guido Seafood Restaurant just before 12 a.m. midnight, a job that she held alongside studying at the University of Texas. After a childhood of dancing, Shelley had big plans to one day open a dance studio of her own. That evening, she was meant to be headed to her boyfriend's house after work, but she never arrived. We know on her way there, she swung by a fast food restaurant to grab a burger, and then she disappeared. After a couple of hours, she hadn't arrived. Her boyfriend Mark was so concerned that him and his dad went out to retrace Shelley's steps and see if they could find her. They didn't come across her, but did find her car, a blue 1980 Ford Pinto, on an access road for the I-45. The driver's side window had been broken and there were bloodstains on the door and the driver's seat, but no trace of Shelley. They, of course, called the authorities, who just assumed that Shelley had been in an accident and had wandered away from the scene disorientated. Seriously, what does it take for the authorities to take the disappearance of a woman seriously? A literal smashed window and blood, and she still apparently walked away of her own accord. The next afternoon, Shelley's parents officially filed a missing persons report, and two witnesses actually came forward to describe how they'd been on the I-45 the previous night and had seen Shelley's car being pursued by a pickup truck. This caused her to slam on her brakes and drive down an access road in an attempt to get away, but this didn't work and the pickup truck just followed her. The witness saw the man drag Shelley from her car into his pickup truck, and then the perpetrator shouted that it was a domestic issue not to get involved, and he looked like he was about to pull out a gun, so the witness backed off. Shelley Sykes has never been found. But there actually was somebody convicted for her abduction, Gerald Peter Zwost. A year after her disappearance, a man called John Robert King phoned the El Paso police and claimed that him and a friend, Zwost, had abducted and murdered Shelley Sykes. He was calling from a motel saying he'd been trying to commit suicide and he was quickly picked up by the authorities. He claimed that they buried Shelley near his home in San Leon, Texas, that it was his own blood on the inside of Shelley's car. However, he made a lot of conflicting statements in his confession, and it seems he didn't fully remember the events of that night, that it was some kind of frenzy. 4 days later, King was fitted with a concealed recorder and he met up with Gerald Zwast, where he tried to make him talk about the events of that night, the events of the abduction. Zwast denied knowing what he was talking about at every step, but regardless, he was soon picked up and questioned by the police. Eventually, he admitted what had happened, but put the majority of the blame on King. Both of them said that the other one was more responsible, and the police were never able to get a solid answer as to how exactly Shelley died that night, but there's even evidence suggests that she might have been buried alive. Because, as we already covered in last week's episode, confessions aren't quite enough for a conviction at this point, police eventually find Zwast's truck and found hairs that matched those pulled from Shelley's hairbrush. They couldn't DNA test in those days, but this was as close as you could get otherwise. At trial, Zwast and King were both convicted of the kidnapping of Shelley Sykes. As they were unable to find her body, they couldn't actually bring forward murder charges, but interviews with the jurors suggest that they did all think that they were also responsible for Shelley's death. I mean, that does make sense, doesn't it? Once in prison, the DA tried to make a deal with Zwast, offering him immunity to a murder charge if he led them to Shelley's body. He agreed and was hypnotised, leading to a massive 3-day search in San Leon, but no body was found. They did find a petite-sized white blouse that Shelley's family are sure was hers. She made a lot of her own clothes and it looked like something she would have made. And the authorities think that Shelley's body was definitely in the field at one time before being moved. King died in prison in 2015 and Zwast was last denied parole in 2017 as it was deemed that he remained a danger to society. But there's no further answers. The district attorney has said that the only reason they ever had any answers as to this crime was because of the Sykes family, because they kept Shelley's name in the media and they refused to let anyone forget that she existed. Had the case just faded away, King and Zwas likely would have gone on with their lives, but the pressure of opening the paper most days and seeing Shelley, turning on the TV and seeing Shelley, got to King and he confessed. That just goes to show how much power there is in keeping people's names in the forefront, not letting people forget about missing or murdered people. On the 7th of October 1988, 22-year-old Suzanne Renee Richardson also disappeared from Galveston. She was a student at Texas A&M University where she majored in maritime administration, and she was employed as a night clerk at Casa del Mar Condominiums on Seawall Boulevard. She was last seen at work at about 6 a.m. that morning, seen by security guards at the resort who left their shifts not long after she arrived. At 6:30 a.m, a guest arrived in the office to check out of their room, but there was no sign of Suzanne. An employee who was sleeping in the room above the office would later report hearing a scream not long after 6 a.m. They heard a car door slam shut, another scream, and the sound of a car speeding away. When the guest arrived to check out about half an hour, 25 minutes later, there was no sign of a struggle, and Suzanne's purse, books and car were later all found exactly where she'd left them. One of her shoes was also located in the car park. Just like Shelley, Suzanne's body has sadly never been found, and her case has often been connected to the disappearance of Sondra Rambert specifically. A task force comprised of local law enforcement and FBI agents called Operation HALT, standing for Homicide Abduction Liaison Team, was formed to investigate these two incidents, but there's never really been any answers. There was one suspect in Suzanne's case, a man named Gabriel Soto, who died of a drug overdose in July 2002. Authorities have said that he might have been involved, but he was never charged with anything. Soto was arrested before his death after allegedly attempting to run someone over with his car, and investigators said that the victim had told them that they had witnessed Soto and Suzanne speaking on the night of her abduction. With Soto's death though, they've been unable to get any further answers. If we're following the timeline moving into the 90s, the next victim would have been Donna Prudhomme, but we've already covered her in regards to her being Janet Doe. There would then be a 5-year lull in disappearances and murders until the disappearances of 14-year-old Lynette Bibbs and 15-year-old Tamara Fisher on the 1st of February 1996. That night, they visited a Houston club for teenagers, and a 22-year-old male would later come forward claiming to have dropped the girls off that night at a motel near the city centre. And the next that's known of them is their bodies being found 2 days later by a rural dirt road in Cleveland, so 80 kilometres north. Both girls had died due to gunshot wounds. It's thought that Lynette was killed first, shot in the face and head, and Tamara tried to run away, receiving a shot in the back of the head. Lynette was found half nude, but there were no signs of sexual assault or even that she was beaten. This case really seems reminiscent of the earlier cases from the 70s to me. Authorities believe that two people might have been involved in their death, and although neither girl had any identification on them at the time, they found Lynette carrying the phone number of her uncle, so that's how they got ID'd. 13-year-old Crystal Jean Baker left her grandmother's house on the 5th of March 1996 to walk to a friend's house. Interestingly, it's claimed by family members that Crystal was actually the great-niece of late actress Marilyn Monroe, and she definitely had her beauty. Crystal had stayed home from school that day, she wasn't feeling very well, and this would later lead to an argument with her grandmother. Crystal wanted to go to a friend's house to pick up some shoes that she'd left there, and her grandmother refused to take her because she was ill. They argued in the driveway, so Crystal just walked off. She wandered to a tyre store nearby and used their payphone to call everyone she could think of to ask for a lift to her friend's house. Her mother, her father, her siblings, they were all busy. So Crystal decides she's going to walk the 5 miles by herself. By this point, her grandmother had already called the police, asking them to go out and search for Crystal as she wasn't allowed to leave, and the police had agreed. But by the time they did the rounds, Crystal was already gone. Just 3 hours later, her body was found sprawled on the gravel shoulder of the river. Her body was in a bad state. It was clear that she'd been badly beaten and had fought back against her abductor, and she had a deep slash across her neck. At the same time Crystal was discovered, her mother was at the police station filing a missing persons report, to which the police did what? You guessed it, filed her as a runaway. Despite her body being found so quickly and her mother visiting the police station for updates every single day, it took 16 days for the authorities to make the connection. 16 days. For 16 days, Crystal's body was lying in the morgue, unidentified, and her mother and the rest of her family were out in the streets searching for her desperately. And because the police had decided she was a runaway, nobody made the connection. It was years later, in 2009, that the police finally conducted forensic testing on the evidence found at the scene of the crime. For years, both Crystal's mum and the evidence clerk at the local PD had individually, without the other knowing, been fighting to get testing done. They both refused to believe there wouldn't be some kind of forensic evidence, especially considering how hard Crystal fought. And after testing was conducted, it was confirmed that semen had been found on her dress, and they had a DNA profile. They also later found skin cells under Crystal's fingernails belonging to that same person. They knew the DNA showed that this was a black male, but they didn't have a match, until eventually they did. Kevin Edison Smith. In January 2010, Smith had been pulled over in a traffic stop in Louisiana, and the police found large amounts of prescription drugs in his car. Louisiana requires DNA collection in all felony arrests, and so the match was made. Smith later agreed to confess to the murder in exchange for the death penalty being taken off the table, and the DA agreed. That was in their best interest anyway, because they had reason to believe that Smith was guilty of other crimes, and if he was dead, they wouldn't be able to get answers on those either. Smith admitted that he got Crystal into his car, likely against her will, although he has denied that, and said that he strangled her with his hands at first before admitting that he used a ligature to kill her. In 2012, Smith was found guilty, receiving an automatic life sentence. Could Smith be guilty of some of the other murders that we've mentioned in this video? On January 13th, 1996, 9-year-old Amber Hagerman vanished whilst riding her bicycle with her younger brother Ricky in a car park of an abandoned grocery store. Ricky decided to head back home, but before Amber could follow, a man driving a black pickup truck snatched her and pulled her inside a van, as witnessed by an elderly man in his garden. 4 days later, Amber's body was found near a creek about 4 miles away from where she'd been taken, in this incredibly secluded area. It was a kind of place you had to know about to be able to find. The suspect was a white or Hispanic male in his 20s or 30s. He was under 6 foot with dark hair. I could do a whole video about Amber's case alone, because this is actually the reason for the Amber Alert, a system to alert people when a child is kidnapped that's now in place in all 50 US states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and 33 more countries. Countless numbers of children have been saved because of the Amber Alert. Just over a year later, 12-year-old Laura Smither disappeared from her home in Friendswood. Laura was a talented ballerina, she was a gifted and talented student, and she was a Girl Scout. You know there are some kids that you're just like, yeah, you're gonna go on to do really great things with your life? That was the kind of kid that Laura was. Laura loved ballet with all of her heart, and she did everything she could to improve her skills, and she'd recently decided that she wanted to become more physically fit to help with her dancing. On the morning of the 3rd of April 1997, Laura came down and asked her mum if she could go for a run before breakfast. Her mum wasn't sure, but Laura promised that she'd be back before the pancakes were ready. 20 minutes, that's all it was. But as you can guess, Laura never came home. As soon as she wasn't back in time, her parents immediately started to worry. Laura was reliable. If she could be, she would always be home on time. So they immediately go out searching, and then they call 911. In a positive turn from the rest of the cases I've spoken about here, luckily the authorities did take this disappearance seriously immediately. The FBI even tapped the family's home phone in case the kidnapper called asking for a ransom, but the call never came. They searched for a long time, the whole community got involved, but eventually people had to go back to their lives. 17 days later, Laura was found in a retention pond 14 miles north of the family home, wedged inside a metal drainage pipe. Her cause of death was determined to be strangulation along with blunt force injuries. On the 17th of August 1997, 17-year-old Jessica Lee Kane disappeared from Lamarck, Texas. She'd been at a restaurant in Clear Lake for dinner, celebrating her performance in a high school musical, and she'd left to drive home, where she would never arrive. Her car would later be found abandoned alongside I-45, with her wallet still inside, and despite volunteers searching for weeks, no sign of her would ever be found. Her remains wouldn't be found for many, many years, until the 18th of March 2016. You see, in 1997, a 19-year-old woman called Tiffany Johnston was kidnapped and murdered from a car wash in Oklahoma, her body being found in a field in Yukon not long after. In 2015, new forensic technology would link DNA found at the scene of Tiffany's body to a man called William Reese, who was already serving a 60-year sentence for kidnapping. After years of denying being responsible for Tiffany's death, he could no longer pretend otherwise. In an attempt to avoid the death penalty, Reese then starts confessing to other murders he had committed, Kelly Cox and Jessica Kane. In July 1997, Kelly Cox disappeared after taking a tour of a local jail with her classmates from the University of North Texas. After leaving, Kelly realised she'd locked her keys in her car, so she headed across the gas station over the street to call her boyfriend for help. And then Kelly disappeared. For years, it was a mystery what had happened to her, but now we know Reese was the one responsible. He led police to graves in southeast Houston and Brazoria County, where Jessica and Kelly's remains were found after two decades. He was charged with the three murders, but shockingly also confessed the murder of 12-year-old Laura Smither as well. As far as I'm able to find, he hasn't actually stood trial for Laura's murder yet. It seems to be pending, so we can't say that he was 100% responsible for that, but we'll wait and see. Moving into the noughties, on the 12th of July 2002, Totsie Harriman disappeared from League City, Texas, when she was visiting family from her home in Florida. Totsie had recently decided she wanted to move closer to her family, so was looking for homes on the day she disappeared, having mapped out a route to drive between League City and Corpus Christi. She left her son's house at 5 a.m. to go on the search, but when a friend tried to call her mobile at 8:30, the phone rang four times before being transferred to voicemail. By 10:30 a.m, all calls were going straight to voicemail, showing her phone had been probably turned off. Totsie was reported as missing not long after, and her car has never been found. It had a distinctive personalised license plate reading Totsie, T-O-T-S-Y. Her body has also never been found, and foul play is suspected. Exactly 1 year later, on the 12th of July 2002, 23-year-old Sarah Trusty disappeared from Algoa, Texas. She had a job cleaning the church on the same street she was last seen riding her bike, and her bike would later be found in the foyer of this church. Her husband would say that she would often be gone for multiple hours, sometimes whole days, on walks or bike rides, so when she didn't immediately come home that evening, he wasn't too concerned. When 36 hours passed, he reported Sarah as missing. 2 weeks later, her remains were found on the Texas City dike by fishermen. I couldn't find her cause of death anywhere. 16-year-old Teresa Vanegas disappeared on Halloween 2006 after attending a party near the Green Cay subdivision. She was last seen around 11 p.m. but never arrived home. Her body was discovered 3 days later in a field across from Dickinson High School. She'd been strangled, raped, and her hair had been cut off. The Dickinson police have interviewed at least 45 people over the last 15 years. They've got DNA evidence, but there's just not enough to nail down any particular suspect. Teresa's family refused to give up. They need closure, and I'm sure with DNA evidence, we will eventually get an answer in this case. Which brings us to our very last Texas Killing Fields victim, 27-year-old Amanda Kellum. Her body was found in a marshy area near water in Omega Bay by two fishermen on the 10th of November 2006, so just a number of days after Teresa. She may have been stabbed and she may have been strangled as well. Although Amanda is the last name on my list, as I said at the beginning of part one of this, you will find other lists with more or less names on them. This case is very subjective. As you can see, these are clearly not all the result of one killer, but instead it's a bit of an epidemic of serial killings within this particular area. If what I read on the internet is to be believed, for decades, teenage girls and young women living in this area have been warned to be careful whilst travelling on and around the I-45. So a lot of people think that this isn't over, this is still a very risky area. I had quite a lot of people commenting on part one of this video saying that you live in the area and telling me your experiences. If you haven't commented yet, then please let me know if you live in the area, what's your experience with this? Is this a story that's told often? Are you told to be careful? Are you aware of this? Is it still risky? Do you feel it's a dangerous area? Let me know. To round this video up, I just want to talk about a couple more potential suspects, starting with a man called Clyde Hedrick. In July 1984, a woman called Ellen Ray Simpson Beeson was murdered and found beneath garbage on a dirt road in Galveston. She was last seen alive in a Texas City nightclub. It took many, many years to get justice for Ellen, but in 2014, Clyde Hedrick was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Hedrick was questioned at the time, but he told the authorities that Ellen had simply drowned whilst they went swimming together after leaving the nightclub, and that was kind of it, he was left alone. But then over the years, he built up quite a list of criminal acts, and listen to this. Enticing a child, criminal trespass, driving whilst intoxicated, terroristic threat, evading arrest, assault, possession of a controlled substance, theft, abuse of a corpse, criminal mischief, unauthorised use of a motor vehicle, attempted arson, assault, and battery. That's a lot of things on your list. That all comes from a court document about Hedrick and his crimes. And that same document also listed that he was a possible suspect in the murders of Laura Miller and Hedy Fye, but no charges were ever brought against him for these, nor was it ever brought up in testimony at the trial. But how did they get Hedrick for Ellen's death after all those years? At first, back in the 80s, investigators ruled Ellen's death as undetermined. It was pretty hard to get a conviction for murder if you didn't know for sure that she was murdered. Hedrick was convicted of abuse of a corpse at that time, saying that Ellen had drowned whilst they were swimming and he panicked and discarded her body underneath a couch on the Galveston Causeway. However, years later her body was exhumed and new forensic evidence showed that Ellen actually died from a blow to the back of the head. So, Hedrick was convicted to 20 years in prison for the crime. This was when he was aged 60 in 2014, but he was actually released after just 8 years in October of last year. Tim Miller has said that Hedrick is a very possible suspect in his daughter's case, but of course there's nothing solid to pin on him. Tim has said, Clyde Hedrick is considered a threat to public safety, and we are asking everyone to be on the lookout if anyone sees him out of the halfway house. A very dodgy guy for sure, but is there any actual evidence? No. Our final suspect though, we have a bit more to explore. Mark Roland Stallings' name first became attached to the killing fields in 2001, when he realised he was going to be stuck in prison for a very long time on an aggravated kidnapping charge amongst other things, and he needed somewhat of a get out of jail free card. Stallings writes a letter to the police claiming that he had murdered women in both Fort Bend and Galveston County, planning that investigators would take him out on site to help with the investigation and then he could escape, but obviously it never worked out that way. One of the women he claimed responsibility for was Donna Prudhomme. He described how he picked her up near Interstate 610, describing how she was wasted. He took her to a motel, did some drugs, and then he killed her, choking her with a seatbelt. He took her body to the Calder oil fields, dumping her body there, allegedly not knowing about the three victims who had been found there years earlier. But why there? Well, it turns out the Stallings used to work on this land as a ranch hand, working for none other than Robert Abel. Stallings has claimed that he was drawn to Abel because they both had this dark side, but Abel would say that Stallings was just an employee, one he actually ended up firing because he was simply bad at his job, too stupid to take instruction, with Abel saying he was too dumb to even string fences. Whatever the reason, it certainly seems that Stallings grew a deep hatred for Robert Abel. He said that when he dumped Donna on Abel's land in full view, that was on purpose. He wanted Abel to be blamed for the crime, and if that's what he intended, we know he succeeded, kinda. Stallings never took responsibility for all the Killingfields murders, and although he was never even convicted for the murder of Donna Prudholm, when Catherine Casey spoke to investigators for her book, they said it was very likely that he was the one responsible. His story matched up with the evidence they had. But they couldn't convict him on confession alone, they needed evidence. He's also a very strong suspect in the murder of Audrey Cook, as well as two unrelated murders in Fort Bend. Although Stallings doesn't have a conviction, he remains in prison, so at least he can't hurt anyone else. So there you go, the Texas Killingfields. This is a story with so many angles, so many things to consider. Why is this area so popular for serial killers? Why do so many girls go missing here and meet such grisly ends? Although a few of our cases here do have convictions, there are so many more which don't. I think the cases in the 70s were likely all connected, or at least the majority of them were, and maybe there were some through the 80s as well. From the 90s onwards, I'm not convinced. They could all be the victims of lone killers. But interestingly, very few of the victims fit the usual MO of a serial killer. A lot of the time, serial killers will go for sex workers, drug addicts, people on the outskirts of society who are struggling and easy to lure in, easy to go missing and nobody will notice. The fact that very few of the victims in this list fit that mould is very interesting. It suggests that maybe more could be connected than we think. The only positive that if it was the same serial killer operating since the 70s till now, they'll be old now, and we've had no more names on this list since 2006. I just hope that as forensic technology continues to improve, we'll get more answers, and maybe we'll get more confessions over the coming years, but this case is so infamous, a lot of people just confess to it just to get their name out there, so it's really, really hard to narrow it all down and actually figure out who is responsible for what. Thank you for watching, thank you so much for sticking with me through two whole episodes of this, and if you can spare any money then please do donate to Texas Egg Research. I will be donating a big portion of the profits of this video towards it as well, so hopefully we can do a bit of good and raise some money to help. I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.